Hello, everyone, and welcome to Staffer, the show about people who work in government or politics at any level and what they take from the experience. I'm your host, Jim Papa, a partner at Global Strategy Group and a former staffer myself. Today, I'm excited to welcome Josh Earnest, Executive Vice President of Communications and Advertising for United Airlines. Many listeners may recognize Josh from his days as White House Press Secretary under President Obama. In fact, Josh was one of the longest-serving members of the Obama team. He joined the president's campaign in February 2007 as Iowa Communications Director, and in a succession of roles that elevated him throughout the campaign and then the administration, Josh wound up being one of the few people who served for the president for a decade, all the way through the campaign and both terms in the White House. Josh's staffer experience stretched well before he joined the Obama campaign, however. He worked on mayoral campaigns in Houston and in New York City, a gubernatorial campaign in Florida, on Capitol Hill for a congressman from Arkansas, and at the DNC, all before he headed to Iowa in 2007. During the campaign, Josh held several roles, including as campaign spokesperson and later as deputy communications director. When the president won, he asked Josh to serve as communications director for the inaugural committee. During Josh's time in the White House, he served as deputy secretary and principal deputy secretary before taking over the podium in 2014. Everyone who knows Josh knows what an intelligent, thoughtful, and truly decent person he is. And if you are anywhere near him professionally or you've watched him during White House press briefings, you also know how good he is. And that's not just admiration from a fellow staffer. Reporters feel the same way. When he had the top job behind the podium, the White House press corps was surveyed anonymously by Politico, and the reporters named Josh the best press secretary they'd ever worked with. I am so pleased to be able to present my conversation with Josh to you. He and I recorded on Friday, March 8th. I hope you enjoy it. Josh Earnest, welcome to Staffer.
Hey, Jim. How are you, man? It's wonderful to be here.
I really appreciate your making time. As you know, this is my ode to staffers and the the careers that they had as staffers and what they've done afterwards. Though I'd like to start at the beginning. So can you talk to us a little bit about where you grew up and what family life was like?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri. So, in the heartland, as they say. Since we're talking politics and since this is Staffer, I'll say that my family was not especially political. I didn't grow up in those families where I like went knocking on doors with my parents or went to the county meetings with them. What I do remember, though, is my parents were regular voters. And I do remember being a kid, walking to the, going with them on election day to cast their vote. That definitely made an impression on me. But my interest in politics, I think, was mostly motivated by sort of a sense of competition. I did play sports growing up. I have two younger brothers. They were both athletes. My dad was a high school basketball coach for much of my childhood. And that is the thing about politics that always appealed to me, was sort of this notion of competition. I'm going to put up my good ideas against your good ideas. We are going to go and make a public case to people about why my idea is better than yours. We are going to engage in a competition to persuade people to come out to vote. We're going to tally up the results. We're going to see who wins. And then if you win, then you get to go and sort of engage in that competition to try to get it through, whether it's the regulatory process or the legislative process. But that sort of sense of competition is something that has always appealed to me about politics.
Well, knowing that about you, it makes perfect sense that you became a spokesperson, and including spokesperson to the president of the United States, because that really is it's a competitive atmosphere. You are talking with reporters who are challenging you each day, and it is a battle of ideas. Every day somebody's trying to knock down your idea while you're trying to advance it.
Yeah. When done well, that's exactly what it should be. I think too often, for my liking, it was not that way. We got sidetracked by things that weren't actually that important. But, the other element of it, Jim, was not just sort of the sort of sense of competition with the journalists in the room, but it was also the sense that people who had different arguments than the ones that I was making were having the same kind of competition for the attention and approval of the American public, or in some cases, because we were fortunate enough to work at the White House, the global public, like making an argument to the world about sort of the way of life that we had and the wisdom of our approach to free markets and democracy and civil rights and all that really good stuff. So that was the other element of it that appealed to me about working at the White House. We were having that competition on the biggest possible stage.
It's so true. And that's something that I think, unless you've been in the very small group of people to stand behind that White House podium, it's hard to appreciate just how much you're speaking to a world stage. Because if you know, when you come up in politics, as most of us do, and as you did, you're talking to domestic audiences, right? Even if you're working for the most well-positioned senator, let's say, 99% of what you're doing is to a domestic audience. But speaking on behalf of the president is a little different. So did that take some getting used to?
It definitely took some getting used to. Recognizing that there would be international sort of consequences for the way that we framed arguments, and also recognizing that some of those arguments were going to get a little lost in translation. That definitely happened. But the other element of it that was also different was sort of the symbolic value attached with speaking at the White House. That standing behind that podium, it was about the symbolism of a person, not necessarily Josh Earnest, but a person representing the president, representing the institution of the White House, representing the United States government, representing the United States of America, sort of the nation, representing the free world. And that was also like a thrill and fun, but challenging. You know, the best story that is the best sort of illustration of this is that there was a moment, this was probably 2014, and all my stories feel like more ancient history than they used to, Jim. So this is probably
I can relate.
10 years or so ago. This was in the midst of a bunch of the start of a bunch of internal strife in Syria. And, you know, we saw that extremists, ISIS extremists were capitalizing on the instability there. And, you know, the Russians at the time were deeply concerned about this dynamic because they basically relied on the Assad regime, who was nominally in power, but quickly losing their grip on power across the country. The Russian government basically moved a bunch of military assets to the capital, Damascus, to protect the Assad regime and keep them in power. But they did it under the guise of fighting extremism. We've seen this. This is like the oldest play in their playbook. But what they did was they took anti-aircraft missiles and stationed them all around the capital to prop up the Assad regime. And again, they said, you know, this is all because, you know, we're trying to counter extremism just like the rest of the free world. And, you know, we talked about this in the briefing. The United States, our allies, and a bunch of other interested observers were deeply concerned about this military buildup by the Russians, and, you know, were dubious about their claims that they were trying to fight extremism. And so I made an offhanded comment where I said, you know, it's interesting that Russia is deploying these S-3000 highly capable anti-aircraft missiles in Damascus. I didn't realize that ISIL had an air force. And like everybody kind of chuckled. Officials in the Russian government didn't think it was very funny. The Russian diplomats in the United States who operate that their handle there posted an image later that day, or maybe it was the next day, of the S-3000 anti-aircraft system, a picture of it. And my picture side by side, but the it was oriented in such a way that the missiles were sort of like pointing at my head as I was like standing behind the podium. And, you know, it was reported as sort of like an implicit, like sort of a hostile counter to what we were saying. And so somebody asked me at the briefing the next day what I thought about it. And, you know, it was the reason that I like that story is it's a really good illustration of this dynamic that I cared a lot about how I presented myself and how I carried myself in the briefing and how I put my own personal imprint on how I would handle questions. But I tried really, really hard, and I think with mostly successfully, to not take it personally. right? It was not about me. The Russian diplomats who were goons were not threatening my life. That was not the intent of the post. It was sort of the symbol of basically countering our messaging and expressing their displeasure and even hostility at the way that we were talking about what they were doing inside of Syria. But again, it gives you a good sense of sort of that international competition of ideas.
It really does. And it is, and you are, you know, you're on the field of the debate in a way that most White House staffers are not, and most staffers are not. So, you know, you joined the Obama campaign in 2007. You are one of the few people who served throughout that campaign and then all the way through both terms in office. When you were first in the White House, Robert Gibbs was the press secretary, and then later Jay Carney, and then you became press secretary. What did you learn about the job from them before you took it? And then I have a follow-up question about how you thought through your particular approach.
Yeah. Having literally a front row seat to the briefing for 5 years before I took that job was an advantage of galactic proportions. It just gave me such a leg up in having some instincts about what was going to work and what wasn't, about identifying the personalities in the room, building some relationships with a lot of the people in the room. You know, being the deputy at that time, and I think this is true in a lot of deputy roles, sort of whether it's in comms or anywhere else, you have an opportunity to build some relationships because people will come to you with questions because they don't really know where else to go. They know they can't go to the top person because their request or their complaint is not fully formed. They also don't want to go to the bottom person because they want to like make their presence known and they want to make their argument heard. But if they think it's not quite ready for prime time, they're going to come to the deputy. And so for 5 years, I did that. I Jim, you may remember where my office was in the White House. You know, if you watch the White House briefing and you see that wall with the White House logo behind the person who's speaking at the podium, my office was on the other side of that wall. And so when reporters who worked in the White House briefing room would come through that sliding door to find someone, they would literally look to their right and I would be in the office. I was the option of first resort for reporters who were mad because they'd gotten scooped, mad because they thought they were wrong about something, confused about what was happening either in the world or at the White House. Sometimes it was often very esoteric questions like, are you guys about to call a lid? Which basically means, are you about to like advise all of us that there's no more news planned? And so I can go home and like pick up my kid at daycare. So there are all kinds of questions that I was fielding. And that those personal connections were a huge advantage to taking the job. But to answer your question more broadly, I definitely learned a lot, both from Gibbs and from Carney, about their style, what worked for them really well, what were some of the things that didn't work great for them. And I definitely, you know, the people who, I don't know why anybody would do this, but anybody who did watch the briefing really closely would be able to detect the elements of sort of the Gibbs's success and Carney's success into my regular routine.
And, you know, in those weeks before you took over the podium, but perhaps you knew, you know, you'd already been offered the job, you were going to take it. When the president talked to you about what he wants in a spokesperson, and you had been his spokesperson before, what are those things that he was looking for?
Yeah. Well, you know, the other advantage that I had come into this Jim, is that Gibbs and Carney were great bosses. Not just because they sort of set an example, as I was describing before, but also because both of them gave me opportunities to really grow in the role that I had. And one of the ways that Jay did that was I did something, I filled in for him when he was out. Sometimes that was on Air Force One, doing gaggles on Air Force One. And again, sometimes that wasn't all out of his interest in my career development. Some of it was in his own interest. And having some kind of family life. He had little kids when he had the job. And like the West Coast weekend trips for fundraising were not exactly high on his list. So some of it was him taking the privilege. But I also had some familiarity and that I'd done the job. And it lowered the bar just a little bit. Maybe I should say lowered the high wire just a little bit. Having done a briefing several times on camera in the briefing room as the deputy before I became the press secretary. But so I knew a little bit about what I was getting into even before President Obama offered me the job. But I do remember going into the Oval Office. There was sort of this quiet process that was being run at the White House because Jay had informed a couple of colleagues and the president that he was ready to step away. You know, he'd been doing the job for more than 3 years at that point and, was ready to, I think understandably, ready to move on to the next phase in his career. And the White House wanted to avoid a big spectacle. And so there was a quiet search that they conducted. And so, it was a kind of a weird process, to be honest with you, because the people that I'd been literally meeting with every single day to talk about our communication strategy for more than 5 years, right? Not just the sort of the 5 years of working in the White House, but also like working on the campaign, Dan Pfeiffer, Dennis McDonough, Jen Palmieri, somebody I interviewed with too. She was a newer addition to the team, but I'd already been talking to her 4 years every day about what we're doing at the White House. So it's like, it's hard to have an interview in that context.
Yeah. Plus in the midst of your day, meeting with them that morning on other stuff and after that interview.
Yeah. And then we're gonna have an interview on exactly the same things we were talking about earlier. So I did get summoned to the Oval Office late one afternoon, by Brian Mosteller, who was President Obama's, a personal assistant who sat right outside the Oval. I went in to talk to the president, and I wasn't quite sure exactly why I had been summoned. I sort of hoped I knew why I had been summoned, but I wasn't quite sure. And so I sort of walked in through the threshold of the Oval. The president was sitting behind the desk, looking at his iPad. And he was either like reading a highly classified national security document, reading the New York Times, or playing words with friends. I wasn't exactly quite sure what he was doing. but he sort of beckoned me in the way that he always did by saying, "Josh, what's going on out there?" And that was my invitation to sort of tell him what was going on in the media space that day. The other thing I remember about that conversation was I remember that President Obama didn't ask me if I wanted the job. I just sort of sat down, we started talking, and he, looked at me and he said, "So you're going to be my next press secretary." and so I remember thinking to myself, I got to keep my cool for the rest of this conversation. But that obviously was tremendous news. The thing that he told me that was really valuable guidance was he said, "Look, you need to know I'm not going to watch your briefing every day. I don't intend to watch your briefing. But if you recognize that there's something, some piece of information that you need, if there's a perspective from me that you need, you need to let me know and we'll discuss it before you go out there." And I was very judicious about exercising that privilege. Didn't use it every day. But when there was something in the news that I knew that he had a strong perspective about, or if there was something that I was having some fact or piece of information or view that I was having trouble sort of getting out of the policy bureaucracy, or if I was getting conflicting views in the policy bureaucracy, then I'd have my assistant call the president's assistant and say, "Hey, I got to get in there. The briefing's at 12:45. Josh's got to get in there. Only needs a couple minutes, but needs some time." And the president was true to his word on that. Now, the place where I think he may not have been true to his word is there were occasionally indications that he had happened to see my briefing. But the thing that he was really, really good at, and this is actually something that I even try to apply in managing my staff, was he never once, to my face, second guessed something that I said at the briefing. This, at my last day at the briefing, that must have been hard for somebody who is widely recognized as the most gifted communicator of his generation, at least. You could probably open up the aperture longer than that. But it's not that controversial, I think, to just say that of his generation, it's hard to think of anybody who is a more skilled communicator. To say nothing of sort of his ability to think on his feet, sort of the nimbleness of his mind, his command of the facts. And to think that he's got all that capacity inside him, but yet he trotted me out there for, you know, an hour and a half every day to speak on his behalf, really, I think, required his just sort of, in some ways, like relaxing and just like letting it go, but also just sort of having confidence that this other person may do it a little differently than I do, but I'm invested in their success. And he knew that my success depended on me not thinking that he was looking over my shoulder and watching every single word that I uttered. And I know there were times where I handled things a little differently than he would have handled it if he were left to his own devices. But I never heard that from him. I never got second guessed. I know later I heard that there were times where he asked other people, why did we decide to do it that way? But he never came to me and said, why did you do it that way? And that meant a lot for giving me sort of the confidence that I needed to walk out there every day and speak authoritatively on his behalf. And the truth is, the person who succeeded me in that job for President Obama's successor had exactly 180 degrees the opposite experience. He did have to perform for his boss. And when he didn't live up to that performance, he heard about it, and it was evident in his performance, and frankly, evidence in the lack of confidence that he showed on a pretty frequent basis.
No, you're right. And there are, I mean, again, that, as we've been talking about, that podium job is unique for so many reasons. And that is one of the things about the job that perhaps people don't really know. What you've just described, that relationship with the president, and the confidence that they can instill or rob from the very person who needs to succeed at a big moment every day.
Yeah. And it doesn't just sort of affect their like well-being, you know, mental well-being or their ego.
That's right.
It genuinely affects their performance and their credibility with the news media, right? If the reporters sort of think that you aren't quite sure exactly what the president's thinking, or if they think the president might disagree with something that you'd said, that can completely undercut every element of your performance. And President Obama, I think, understood that and was very conscious of not doing that for me and for the other spokespeople who worked for him.
You know, I mentioned big moments, which as press secretary you had every day in the briefing room. But just last night, there was a very big moment for President Biden, who delivered the State of the Union address. And by all accounts, he killed it. He gave a great speech. He delivered it with such strength. You have been a part of that process of both, you know, building the speech, preparing the speech, and all of the media prep that goes in, you know, before, during, and after that speech. Can you give us a little bit of insight on that process and what you took away from President Biden's speech?
Yeah. I'll start by one piece of color, which is maybe I should lobby for you to change the name of this podcast to X Staffer, because last night watching the State of the Union, I felt like an X Staffer. When the speech was ready to come on, I wasn't exhausted. I hadn't been up for like 16 hours, and I wasn't sort of faced with post game interviews or early morning interviews the next day. I like sat on the sofa in my sweatpants with my wife and watched the speech. It was great. After reading a book to my kids, like,
right.
Ex-staffer life is awesome. but I agree with you, Jim. I thought the president crushed it. He did a couple of things tactically that I thought were really, really smart. The first is, and people probably perceive this, his cadence was quick yesterday. Like, he spoke rapidly. And so much so that there were times where he stumbled over words the way that anybody would if they were giving an hour and 9 minute soliloquy. when they're trying to go quickly. But it was worth it. He and his team made a calculation that going quick would infuse him with energy, and they were 100% right on that. He seemed energetic because he was talking fast. The second thing that they did that I thought was also really smart is, you know, if you go back and look at previous State of the Unions, and the truth is, I'll bet even President Obama did this occasionally, would start the speech, Madam Vice President, Mr. Speaker.
Yes.
You know, like long series of introductions and honorifics that are also, intermittently interrupted by applause. Like, is there anything that drains the energy out of something quicker than a long introduction of a bunch of people who really enjoy being introduced?
That's right.
So he dispensed with all of that, and he just dove right in. In fact, it took him a long time before he even got to sort of the state of our union is strong and getting stronger. So I thought that was also like a tactical small thing made a tremendous difference in his performance. So I know that, you know, everybody was sort of like an amateur ice skating judge last night, sort of judging the performance and whether he hit the triple sow cow and all that in his speech. He was sort of stuck with that lot, but he just embraced it. And so I think he embraced the responsibility that he had to demonstrate an energetic, strong performance, and he delivered. But it's not inconsequential that he actually had a really sound messaging strategy too. And, you know, the thing that really came through to me, I think there are two things that came through to me. One, they telegraphed really well in advance, so it was not a surprise to anybody, was he really set up the argument as, I'm fighting for you, that other guy's fighting for himself. That came through clearly in the lead up to the speech. It came through vividly in the speech. And I hope it's a theme that they continue to drive, because I think it's really powerful. That means is what they basically are acknowledging is the people who are on the other guy's team really like that he's fighting for himself and their team. But turns out the math doesn't bode well for them, because that is a minority of the country, even if you're just looking at the Electoral College. So if you can really make this forceful argument to the people that are on our team and to the people who are uncomfortable being on either team, that President Biden's going to fight for you, that's a pretty, I think, winning argument. The second thing is, this was important for somebody who I think is countering a bunch of questions and doubts about his age, is he couched so many of his arguments in the context of the future and did not let this sort of devolve into like in many cases had been like decades long debates about how to deal with immigration, about how to get to a fair tax system, about how to get to a fairer, better, more effective healthcare system, about how to manage the finances of the country more responsibly. It would be really easy, and I'm sure is really tempting for somebody who spent almost four decades in the in the Senate, has now spent a decade in the White House. It'd be easy to go back and relitigate all that stuff, and he didn't give into that instinct at all. And really couch this in terms of what the future opportunities are. And setting this up as a fight for your future, I thought was a really smart way to position the arguments. And I think that is substantively, those are the two reasons that I thought his speech was so good.
I could talk to you about both tactics and strategy all day, because I love hearing you dissect a speech like that, and not just what it says, but what it is saying, big picture, and how it's setting up a broader argument, which you've spent a career doing in politics and government service. Today, you are Executive Vice President of Communications and Advertising at United Airlines. You bring all of that background into this job, which you've held now for a couple of years. How does your experience being a spokesperson and developing communication strategies for a president and, you know, speaking from that podium on behalf of the White House, how do you take those learnings and apply them to a company and a brand?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, and in some ways sort of takes me back to, you know, about, you know, 6 years ago when I was interviewing for this job. You know, that was the crux of the interview. I'm not an airline expert. I've never worked in the corporate world. So nobody at United Airlines is going to hire me because of anything I know about airplanes or how to run a global airline. Nobody at United Airlines is going to hire me because I know anything about how to manage a business or how to communicate effectively around managing a business. But there was one thing that I do know about, and that is, how do you help a really prominent brand navigate a noisy, messy world? And that is something that we did in the Obama campaign. That is something that we did in the White House, both with the Obama brand, the White House brand, and the U.S. brand, to sort of go back to the global discussion that we were having before. And so there are some applicable lessons about how to then use the lessons of defending those brands and apply them to defending and promoting the United brand. So some of those lessons, again, are like pretty tactical. Like one of those lessons is, in the same way that we had a battleground state strategy on the campaign, where we focused a whole bunch of our efforts in battleground states in terms of messaging and organizing, we do the same thing. We've got 7 hubs around the country. I'm gonna test myself and name them all. Right, Newark, New Jersey, Dulles Airport outside DC, Chicago, Houston, Denver, San Francisco, and LA. Those are the markets where we know we've got a large concentration of customers and employees. So why would we focus our efforts there? So we've done that in a variety of ways. I've got staff. You know, in many cases, we're pretty lean, so it's just one staffer, but one communications person who works at the Denver airport representing United Airlines and is focused on representing and advancing and promoting and defending the United brand in the Denver media market, just like you would in a campaign. We did a Super Bowl commercial this year that promoted how United Airlines doesn't have change fees. And we don't have the budget to do a nationwide Super Bowl ad. I think it was $7 or $8 million for the 30-second spot. We don't have that kind of money in our advertising budget that we can dedicate to 30-second ad. But what we can do is go buy a bunch of local spots. And so we bought local spots in places like Chicago, Denver, and Houston, and then in some competitive markets for us where we know we're competing with some of the other guys, Baltimore, Kansas City, Cincinnati, Cleveland. And then what we did is we took that up a notch and we actually taped different versions of the ads in some of those markets based on the sponsorship relationships we have with the NFL franchises in those markets. So our Denver spot started off with, hey, Broncos fans. And it was a way for Denver fans, and the whole spot was sort of around this idea that we actually had Kyle Chandler, you know, the coach, Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights. And he's speaking directly to the camera, and he basically says, you know, today we're watching other people's teams play. It's in the Super Bowl. Broncos fans, our team didn't make it. But if we believe hard enough, next year they can. They can turn it around. And so he sort of has like a sort of motivational speech. And then the tagline at the end was, but if it doesn't work out, and he's, oh, and so he said, if we believe hard enough, we should just book our tickets to next year's Super Bowl. Because if we believe hard enough, we can make that happen. And then the tagline was, but if it doesn't work out, you don't have to pay fees to change your flight on United.
I love that.
And so it worked great, but we got all kinds of local coverage in these markets where we've got a concentration of employees and customers. And that is, you know, that is something that is pretty unprecedented in the corporate world. But that is a, you know, that is a tried and true tactic in a campaign environment. And I, you know, it's a great sort of, you know, there are a whole lot of things in our advertising world that are really sophisticated that we didn't try in politics, at least when I was there. But it's nice to see when some of the more tactics, some of the tactics that we know worked really well in politics also apply in the sophisticated corporate world too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that I want to ask you about that you may draw on some staffer lessons, but you can tell us, is how you manage a team. I mean, you did, when as you were coming up through politics and in government, and now you are again at United. You know, how do you, what learnings do you bring to that from your previous iterations in your career to how you run your teams today?
Yeah. It's a really good question. Something I think about a lot. I'll answer that question in two ways. The first is the thing that I have a much better appreciation for now at this stage in my career than I did earlier in my career is the extent to which the culture of an organization is so profoundly shaped by the habits and values of the person at the top. Even in really large organizations, even in the White House, for instance, President Obama's manner of interacting with other people, the way he treated people, the way that he celebrated with them, the way that he held them accountable, the way that he expressed his frustration, the way that he asked questions, the way that he made decisions, his manner, even if you didn't have regular meetings with him in the Oval Office, you knew how he made decisions because the people around him did the same thing. And it turns out that as human beings, we're really efficient at watching how the people above us in the pecking order operate and apply that in our own habits. I've come away with a real appreciation, and I've seen that in the private sector too. But I've just come away with a real appreciation for the extent to which the person at the top of the food chain can really influence their culture of a broader organization. And so, I've tried to be mindful of that as I'm leading my team. And, you know, one small example for President Obama, in terms of the way that he interacted with people, he would, I'm sure you saw this actually when you were working in the White House and your interactions with President Obama, when, you know, he saw you a lot in your role as you're advising him on legislative challenges. But occasionally in those legislative discussions, an arcane policy issue would come up. And so somebody would get pulled out of the bureaucracy of the U.S. government and pulled into this world where they would have to brief the President of the United States. And President Obama had this instinct that was obvious to people who were around him all the time, because it was not uncommon when I was briefing him for, while he was listening to me, for him to like be scrolling through his iPad, for him to listen to what I was saying, but to be pretty casual about it, just to be generous, right? But if it was somebody right. new that he didn't know, he recognized that this was the highlight of this person's career. And when that person mm-hmm. would start to talk, his posture would change. He would always sit right up. He'd put his iPad down and he would look at that person. Sometimes he would ask them questions. Sometimes he wouldn't. Sometimes he would just listen and he would look at them and say, thank you for the prep. He was conscious, and his way of treating people that he had never seen before, and in some cases would probably never see again, but he knew how important this was to them. And it just made it made a real impression on me, and I know it made an impression on other people who were around the president frequently. So I'm trying to be conscious of that as well. The other thing that is also a real takeaway from my experience in the White House that has less to do with the president, but more about the way that we ran the press operation in the Obama White House is, and this is true from the very first day, from the jump at the White House, is that we worked really hard. And some of this is Gibbs's, Robert Gibbs, we mentioned, talked about him earlier. He was President Obama's first press secretary, Robert Gibbs. He believed passionately in empowering the people who worked for him. And so there are people with assistant press secretary titles who are dealing with White House reporters on really high stakes stories, giving them on the record quotes, managing stories, pushing back on assertions that they disagreed with. And this was a dramatic, White House reporters at the beginning were a little taken aback. They're like, why is this junior person talking to me on the record? Why are they pushing back on my story? Usually that's something that the press secretary does. But I think Gibbs rightly acknowledged he didn't have the capacity to both do the daily briefing, be a senior advisor to the President of the United States, and manage the day-to-day stories that the New York Times, for example, is working on. He empowered his team to do it. And I try to take the same approach when I'm dealing with my spokespeople at United. Let me know if you have questions. Let me provide some guidance. I'm going to tell you the stories I really care about, and the stories I care about, you need to come and talk to me and keep me informed of what's going on. But otherwise, you got to go and run it. And don't let me be a bottleneck to making sure that we are handling those stories in the best possible way. And that is a direct a direct lesson from the way that Gibbs ran that first White House press office. And that's, frankly, how we ran the campaign, too.
Yeah. So what in your mind, as you're looking either to hire today or, you know, as you reflect back on, you know, the many staffers who you worked with, what in your mind makes a great staffer?
A great staffer is one that's got passion, one who visibly and obviously cares about what they're working on. And so that's one of the pieces of advice that I tell, particularly to younger people who are earlier in their career. Don't waste your time working on something that you don't really care about. And definitely don't go work for a candidate that you're not that excited about just because you think that he or she is going to win. It's not worth it. It's not glamorous enough. You're definitely not getting paid enough. And you're not going to be as good at your job. Go work for somebody that you actually, or a cause that you actually believe in. The second thing is, and this piece of advice, this is another piece of advice that I've been given for a long time. It's being challenged by recent developments in technology, but I think I'm still going to be right in the end, which is your ability to communicate cogently and persuasively and quickly in writing is of paramount importance and is a skill that will never go out of style. We have these AI tools that can do incredible things right now, but they can't do it on their own. And then the follow-up to that is rarely, with very few exceptions, that's not God-given ability. That is the ability to write quickly and cogently and persuasively is something that you only learn to do by practicing. You learn to do it by doing it. And being around people who are good at it, that helps too. You know, and occasionally when I'm spending time, like, you know, the person who is another staffer who's brilliant at this is Cody Keenan. He was President Obama's chief speechwriter. And, you know, so I'm tempted to say there's actually no God-given ability there. I think of Cody, who is just like a wonder kid. He's a master. He's brilliant. And like watching him even in high stakes, high pressure moments, like, hurry up, we got to get this written. And then you look at it and you're like, you could have given me a week to write that and it would not have been nearly as good. So I always check myself there. And you can even tell Cody that I said that. But for those of us that aren't blessed with that ability, any opportunity that you have to take on a job or even a class if you're still in school, that will challenge you to write and write frequently and get feedback on that writing regularly, or to spend time in a job with somebody that you know is really good at it, those are really good career opportunities because it's going to make you, it's going to equip you with a skill that is going to be sought after by employers.
Well, this is only a podcast, so people can't see my vigorous nodding throughout the entire time you were talking about writing, but I'm in full agreement. Josh, we are coming up to the bottom of the hour here, and though I have many, many, many more questions I could ask you, there is one that I always like to ask, and this will resonate with you, I hope, because you are a baseball fan, and I know you love the Kansas City Royals.
I do.
I have this fantasy that one day I'll be able to raise the money and get the permitting to build a Hall of Fame to staffers and put it on the National Mall. My question for you is, if I'm able to do that, who would you nominate to the Staffer Hall of Fame and why?
Present company excluded, I assume.
Of course, yes. As I like to tell people, if I'm building the museum, I'm going in there.
That's really good. Let's see, who would I... I haven't given this any thought other than since you just asked me the question. I am going to say one worthy person for somebody that'd be worthy for the first class is Susan Rice. And the reason that I say single her out is I have enormous respect for Susan. And I was often manifested on Air Force One on international trips to sit next to her in the senior staff cabin. And that meant that I got to know her a little bit. That means I got to know her well. But it also meant I had a front row seat to how hard she worked. And we would travel. And I thought to myself, you know, I would tease her all the time that she didn't need to bring any workout equipment on the trip because she just could carry around her binders. And she didn't need to hit the gym because she would just come back ripped carrying these things around. Now, fortunately, she had a whole, she was the national security advisor at the time. So she had a whole coterie of people around her who could carry her binder around. But the reason that I would nominate her for consideration in the inaugural class of the Staffer Hall of Fame is she worked incredibly hard. She had an incredible range of talent. The fact that she was the national security advisor for President Obama and then was hired to be to run the Domestic Policy Council for President Biden is an indication of just her her intellect and God-given ability to analyze policy and to make really good decisions and offer really good advice around that. She's also unfailingly loyal to her boss. I certainly saw that with President Obama. When you're dealing with the range and complexity of issues that she was managing, I'm sure there were times where President Obama arrived at at least a slightly different conclusion than she would have arrived at on her own. But there was never a hint of daylight between the president's decision and her implementation of his decision. And the last thing, and this is was also really important to me when I was in the White House, she was also unfailingly loyal to her colleagues. She'd tell you if she disagreed to your face. She would offer you constructive feedback. But I always knew 100% of the time that that she had my back. And this was really important because in the same way that President Obama wasn't sort of second-guessing me while I was at the podium, I was dealing with a lot of complicated, nuanced foreign policy issues that Susan and her team were trying to manage. And I'm sure there are times where she would catch a glimpse of that screen and be thinking to herself, I hope he doesn't screw this up. And even though I know there were times, because she told me later, that I didn't handle it exactly the way that she would have, I never walked away from those conversations feeling discouraged or doubting whether or not she had confidence in me and was supporting me. Now, I'd like to think that some of that was because I was pretty good at my job, but most of that was that Susan was just a consummate team player. And she knew that our success depended on all of us linking arms and being totally invested in one another's success. And I knew that she was totally invested in my personal success because she knew that was good for the team. And somebody who is that talented and that committed to the collective success of the team is somebody that I and could do that at the highest, most competitive, most pressure-packed moments and levels is somebody who is worthy of inclusion in the inaugural class of the Staffer Hall of Fame.
Hear, hear. That is a tremendous nomination. She is in.
Good.
And Josh, thank you. I've loved talking with you today. I've enjoyed all of our conversations. I'm longtime admirer of you behind the podium, and so much of what you've done is really a lesson to those who've had the opportunity to work closely with you, but also to those who've only seen you from afar. So thank you for making time for us today and giving us insight.
Well, Jim, that's very kind of you, man. I really appreciate you saying that. I loved the opportunity that we had to work together in the White House. It was a lot of fun. And I've also, you know, really been impressed at the post-White House career that you built for yourself as well. So it's fun to sit here and trade notes. And I really appreciate you inviting me to be a part of the conversation today. It was a lot of fun.
Okay, everyone, I hear the gavel pounding this meeting to a close, which means this episode of Staffer is adjourned. I want to thank you all for listening to the only show created for and about the people who work in government and politics at any level. I do have a quick favor to ask. Please follow, subscribe, and like the show on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Positive reviews are everything in this business, I'm told. And make sure to sign up for episode alerts at staffershow.com and check out Staffer Show on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.